The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'll say this is a new book, and yet it's not that new a book. Paul Blanc and I edited this almost 25 years ago. And so it's been out of print and unavailable for a good while, and so we're very appreciative to Haymarket for bringing it back, and I hope you'll check it out. On social media a week or two back, I said, you know, preparing my talk on the Russian question and state capitalism has reduced me to a degenerated working state, which a couple of people will get. So I'm glad to see so many people coming, notwithstanding. Let's see. In the Where We Stand statement, which you'll find in the new member's handbook and in most ISO publications, I believe almost every issue of Socialist Worker runs it, you'll find in the section on internationalism a short paragraph at the end that says that China and Cuba, like the former Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc, have nothing to do with socialism. We support the struggles of workers in these countries against the bureaucratic ruling class. Now, until fairly recently, there was a third sentence in the middle of those two, which said of Russia, China, and the like, they are state capitalist regimes. We voted to remove that line a few years ago after a discussion in which it became very clear that even comrades strongly influenced by the British Marxist Tony Cliff did not consider his adherence to his specific analysis of the Russian question to be anything like a prerequisite for membership, or indeed for leadership in the organization. Not that we have repudiated the theory. Even without taking a poll, it seems clear that a very large portion of the cadre still accept Cliff's analysis, and any new member should make time to study from worker state to state capitalism, which is one of the three or four International Socialist Tradition books which Haymarket keeps in print and which you can find in the book room. However, there's been a developing appreciation over recent years in the ISO for the work of Ernest Mandel, Michael Lowy, and Daniel Ben Said, all of them associated with what is called the orthodox Trotskyist analysis of the Soviet system as a degenerated worker state. Tony Cliff's venerable Building the Party is still very much recommended for everyone to study, but more and more comrades, I find, are also studying Lenin and the Revolutionary Party by Paul LeBlanc, who is, unless he's changed and not told me about it, is an adherent to the degenerated worker state thesis. I'm aware of at least one person in the leadership who holds to the old bureaucratic collectivism thesis, and there's a certain degree of curiosity about the current, known as Johnson-Forrest tendency, which also held that the USSR was a form of state capitalism. Now, it's been said that by some new comrades that they don't really understand the theory of state capitalism. They don't really care to understand the theory of state capitalism. It seems like a lot of work to get to it. And in any case, the real valuable thing about it is that it's a label that you can say, well, that's what we don't want, and it's capitalist, and we don't want it because it's capitalist. The values and uses of it as an epithet, be that what they are, don't negate the fact that actually having some sense of the history and the argument behind that category is really worth having. I find that generally folks, anyone who's joined within probably the last 20 years is much less likely to know than older comrades what happened after the revolution, after the Bolsheviks took power. So I'm going to go through some of that as quickly as possible, then look at some of the arguments over what happened, and then finally we'll look at the state capitalism theories themselves. Associated with the venerable myth of the October Revolution as a Machiavellian conspiracy is another piece of counterfeit history, which holds that Lenin had the blueprints for a planned economy up his sleeve that the Bolsheviks put into practice once they had taken power. Let's not waste any time on such bullshit, but instead begin with three pertinent realities which any honest account of events must take into consideration. One, What the revolutionaries inherited in 1917 was an economic system and a state verging on total collapse after 3 years of world war conducted by a czarist government in which corruption vied with incompetence in both military and economic affairs. They soon faced almost 3 more years of truly horrific civil war, including the destructive power of 14 invading armies seeking to strangle the Bolshevik baby in its cradle, to quote Winston Churchill, who liked the idea. Two, at no point did Lenin, nor while he was alive any other Bolshevik, believe that they could remain in power or even alive without the assistance of victorious revolutions in the more highly industrialized countries, especially Germany. And three, to navigate this almost unimaginably complex situation, the Bolsheviks had to experiment, improvise, and just plain wing it. The long-term goal of a planned economy was inspiring, but the need to avoid complete social and economic implosion tended to be more urgent. Before looking at the main phases of economic development over the 20 years or so following the revolution, we need to understand the enormity of these initial immediate circumstances. The historical analyses I've seen usually take Russia's economic state in 1913 as a benchmark. What we find is that by 1921, the gross output of all industry in Russia was at 31% of what it had been in 1913. Now keep in mind, when we're talking Russia in 1913, we're talking what would in today's parlance probably be called a third world country. Agricultural output was at 60% in 1921 of what it had been in 1913. That in turn, you need to keep in mind that as of 1910, the male agricultural worker in Russia was capable of producing only half of what one in England or the US could 50 years earlier in terms of millions of calories produced per day per worker, per agricultural worker. Lenin's famous comment that socialism equals the Soviets plus electrification comes in a new light when you see that by 1921, Russia was producing about a quarter as many kilowatts as it did before the war. And you can imagine, like, there was not rural electricity in Russia in 1913. Now, the stages, I've divided things up into about 4 main stages of what happened after the initial months, 1917, 1918. There's still a lot of chaos from the end of the withdrawing from the war. Everything's in disorder. Lenin has a pamphlet during this period, which is talking about like what do we do next? And an awful lot of it comes down to we need to keep people from stealing all the stuff from the factories and selling it off, whether that's the owners of the factories themselves or workers or demobilized soldiers who are just trying to get enough money to have, you know, to keep body and soul together. And we need to draw every single worker into the business of managing this economy, which means taking inventory in a way. I mean, that's the state things were at. The urgent task was, let's get everybody to learn how to take inventory, okay? So that's where things are before the Civil War really kicks in. And the period between 1918 and the very beginning of 1921 has become known as military communism because every priority was organized around the simple, urgent need to defend the revolution from complete destruction by the counter-revolutionaries and the invading armies. So basically, this tended to answer any question about what priorities would be. What should we do with it? What should be the goal that we're looking for with any given economic activity? It also meant that keeping the army fed, keeping everybody fed, that keeping the army fed had to be at the top of the list, meant requisitioning grain. What this meant was going out to the countryside, leaving the peasants with enough for themselves to live on so they could keep at it, and basically taking by force if necessary, and usually it was necessary, the available grain. There was extensive rationing. Trotsky characterizes this period as, I don't have it right in front of me. He says basically this is the economy of a fortress. You know, everything is dedicated to keeping the fortress alive. This is the requisitioning and rationing are sometimes brutal, but they're absolutely necessary. Just like war is often brutal is always brutal and often necessary, sometimes necessary. There's a tendency during this period, because things like money are rapidly losing any value, to say this kind of level of rationing, everybody gets an equal share of the available commodities, such few commodities, whether foodstuffs or otherwise, that we are able to produce. Everyone gets an equal share of it. If you're a worker, regardless of how productive you've been during a given day, you just get that. But it's not very much, okay? That's sort of the essence of war communism for anyone outside the military. For some of the Bolsheviks, there's a tendency to make a virtue of necessity, and to say, this is not only a temporary measure, but this is, in a way, sort of what we're looking for. This will build on this basis. Now, Nikolai Bukharin, who's a very brilliant Bolshevik intellectual theorist, writes a book during this period called Economics of the Transition Period, in which he's saying, making basically this kind of argument. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to build on. This seems to be working. Let's keep doing it. The problem, of course, is that the peasants really, really don't like this. And 80% of the population is peasant. And so you begin to have revolts. You begin to have people who say, well, I'm not going to produce any more than I need to feed myself and my family. If you're going to come and take it, and you're not giving me anything. Trotsky says, the peasants were given colored pieces of paper, which, according to ancient legend, were money. It was a rumor that this thing had value at some point. It didn't then. And they weren't getting real commodities because industry had collapsed. So the connection between the city and the countryside was extremely strained. You had the revolt at Kronstadt in 1921, which the Bolsheviks put down, and some of them, I think, spent the rest of their lives wondering if they had had to do that. And so during this period, Lenin sees, Trotsky had seen a little bit earlier, actually, and had proposed something like this idea of moving to a sort of a mixed economy in which peasants would be taxed a certain amount for grain, but anything that they produced above and beyond that, whether for themselves or for the market, they could sell. And that this would encourage them then to go out and plant more and produce more and so on and so forth. So Lenin announces this he proposes this, and he has to fight tooth and nail to get the rest of the party leadership to accept this idea, because it is perceived to be, and in fact it is, and he acknowledges this, a retreat in a way. This is letting capitalism back in, and there's really no way around that. He's very clear on that, and he says so. The tax in kind is kind of the linchpin of this phase of it. The peasants produce a tax in kind of what they produce enough for to meet their tax to the government. The government then uses that to pay the military, pay industrial workers in the cities, and so forth, or provide it to them anyway. The dangers of this approach are obvious. For one thing, you've got more and more people who are becoming not just productive farmers, but in some cases relatively well-off farmers, and people whose job it is, whose role it is to be the middleman, the business agent for the better-off farmers and selling to the cities, someone who steps in to get his or her little cut of whatever is being produced in the city that's available to the countryside. So again, this is a real kind of a concern for the Bolsheviks. During this period, there's also a lot of habits left over from the war period among Bolshevik party members. There's a tendency to kind of say, well, if somebody's come up with a good idea, we assume it's a good idea because they wouldn't have come up with it if they hadn't been, if they weren't like experienced good comrades. We could trust them like we trust our generals, like we trust our commanders. And so, everybody agrees, right? We vote. Everybody agrees, sure? And there's no more discussion, right? So this is really bad for proletarian democracy. And these habits worry Trotsky, among others. Let me say a little about the effectiveness of this new economic program. By 1926, industrial production was above pre-war levels, and almost twice as much electricity was generated than before the onset of the war. And that, to put it another way, is that they had gone from the level, the output of electricity in 1921, they had increased it six times over by 26. And there are a number of other statistics you can cite from this period. I won't go into too much of it, except to say that the agricultural economy really gets back on its feet again. By 1926, 27, 28, both farmers and workers are getting more or less what they had in pre-revolutionary or pre-war period, and they're beginning to have some degree of commodities being available for purchase for consumer goods on the market. Now, this is also this period. There are debates within the Bolshevik Party. And at one point, Trotsky tries to argue for what he's experimented with, which is demobilizing soldiers and turning them into sort of labor shock troops. If you've got a factory that's not working, that's, you know, it's been pilfered and it's falling apart, badly directed, you send the troops in, they get it back on its feet again and producing. And Trotsky at one point tries to put forward the idea, well, maybe this is what we should turn the labor unions into, the trade unions into, you know, an industrial army of sorts. And Lenin is very, very much opposed to this. For one thing, he says, okay, Trotsky, you're arguing that we have a worker state. That is an abstraction. What we have actually here is a workers and peasants state, which keeping the two connected is a major part of what we have to do. And we have growing bureaucratic deformations, including the stuff that I talked about with the kind of command mentality left over from the Civil War. But also people who had maybe decided not to leave Russia after the revolution, but they really figured the Bolsheviks were gonna fall apart, you know, give them 6 months and they'll disintegrate. And so they stuck around, and then eventually they see, well, they're staying in power, maybe I should get on board this train. Okay, so you get more and more people being drawn into government service who are not really, you know, with the program. They're opportunists, basically, to be as nice as possible about it. And so at one point, Lenin makes a remark to the effect of, you know, we have a proletarian leadership here of trained, tempered Bolsheviks, which is a thin layer on top of this big, growing machine of bureaucracy. And you know, can we say that the party is leading the state, or is the state starting to lead the party on this? And what direction is it going? Now, Lenin was profoundly worried about this in his final working months. And the period following his death, and even beginning a little bit before his death, since he was incapacitated for a while, is one of great debates in Russia, both on world perspectives and on the sort of the questions of economic development in Russia itself. The defeat of the German Revolution is profoundly disorienting. In the wake of that, there's a growing call to see the duty of the party as building socialism in one country. Now, this is an absurd idea to any old Bolshevik who's been paying attention over the past, because socialism requires developing a very high degree of productivity. And you know, this is a country that's barely gotten up to what it was at pre-war levels. How are you going to do that by your lonesome? However, Bukharin is actually, we think of socialism in one country as Stalin's dogma, but it was actually come up with Bukharin, who during this period has become extremely enthusiastic about the new economic policy and thinks it's pretty much the way that things are going to be for the foreseeable future. So we're sort of once again back to, this seems to be working, let's keep doing it. And so this idea of building socialism at a snail's pace, oh good lord, is, I'm going to be here for a while, is disastrous. It's the right wing of the options available. Trotsky and the left opposition are concerned with what's called the scissors, which is the growing disparity between the price of agricultural products and the price of industrial products. The peasants are basically not able to sell their stuff for enough to be able to afford to buy any of the stuff, you know, tractors or axes or whatever is being produced in the city. And so this is a real danger. I'm going to start skipping like crazy here, except to say that these debates include a period of great creativity on the part of economists who are trying to figure out how to go forward to both industrialize the country, build on the economic success of the agricultural reforms, and integrate those things. And it basically, by the 1950s and 60s, bourgeois economists are looking back on this and saying, these guys have figured out, are anticipating what, you know, they call modernization. And so the questions, however, are really settled by 1928-29, because there's a sort of a strike by some of the peasants. There's a panic response on the part of the government, which leads to breaking down on peasant resistance. They go hell bent on industrialization. They not only create a plan for the economy with targets, which are not created from the democratic discussion that you have to have over what do we want, how are we going to produce it. But they're just kind of almost arbitrarily and extremely high set targets are set, which if you don't meet them as a factory director or whatever, you are punished, and severely punished, and replaced. And so there's an incentive to lie. And how do you have a planned economy when people are lying about what they're actually producing? And so you create more and more chaos, and more severe repression. In the industry that is building up, they managed to create heavy industry within a few years, but at the cost of just unbelievable repression in the factories. From 1928-29 on, there's a real campaign basically to blame all economic problems on the working class. Okay, you're lazy. You're not showing up for work. You need to, yeah, and so not only is there's this propaganda campaign is the nice part, then you get the period when if you show up late for work, you get sent to a camp, and if you steal anything, God help you, you're dead. One estimate for this period is that aside from this kind of repression, the wages fall drastically, and so. By one estimate, the wages fell by 50%, while productivity increased three times. That brings us to the question posed for revolutionary socialists after this new industrialized Stalin-led system has consolidated: of what is it? Do we support it? Do we not support it? Is this a class society? If so, what kind is it? Trotsky in The Revolution Betrayed writes, the basis of bureaucratic rule is the poverty of society and objects of consumption, with the resulting struggle of each against all. When there are enough goods in the store, the purchasers can come whenever they want to. When there are few goods, the purchasers are compelled to stand in line. When the lines are very long, it is necessary to appoint a policeman to keep order. Such is the starting point of the power of the Soviet bureaucracy. It knows who is to get something and who has to wait. And of course, it gives itself the first place in that queue. In a text from 1931 called Problems of the Development of the USSR, Trotsky says, the character of the social regime is determined first of all by the property relations. The nationalization of land, of the means of industrial production and exchange, with the monopoly of foreign trade in the hands of the state, constitute the bases of the social order of the USSR. the classes expropriated by the Great October Revolution, as well as the elements of the bourgeoisie and the bourgeois section of the bureaucracy being newly formed, could reestablish private ownership of land, banks, factories, mills, railroads, etc., only by means of a counter-revolutionary overthrow. By these property relations lying at the base of the class relations is determined for us the nature of the Soviet Union as a proletarian state. Now, in a an article criticizing Trotsky's assessment, but being scrupulously fair in presenting aspects of his argument, Max Shachtman, who was one of the three founding members of American Trotskyism, Shachtman elaborates on Trotsky's point by saying, "But it is not a worker state in the abstract. It is a degenerated, a sick, and internally imperiled worker state. Its degeneration is represented by the usurpation of all political power in the state by a reactionary totalitarian bureaucracy headed by Stalin. It serves to maintain the social rule of the proletariat. At the same time, however, it weakens and undermines this rule. To assure the sanitation and progress of the worker state toward socialism, the bureaucracy must be overthrown. Its totalitarian regime excludes its removal by means of more or less peaceful reform. It can be eliminated, therefore, only by means of a revolution. The revolution, however, will be, in its decisive respects, not social but political. It will restore and extend workers' democracy, but will not produce any fundamental social changes, no fundamental changes in property relations." That's the end of the quotation from Shachtman summing up Trotsky. In short, then, the proletarian revolution created a national economy organized around collective property, which, under the exercise of working class power in its various forms, Soviets, trade unions, and a revolutionary party, or arguably parties in the Soviets, would be moving at whatever rate towards socialism, and faster if there are revolutions, and particularly in Europe, particularly in Germany. If working class rule is replaced by a bureaucracy driven by its own self-interest, we have a degenerated worker state, atop an economy that is essentially the last surviving product of the proletarian revolution. The bureaucracy, with an interest in preserving its own privileges, has reason to preserve this arrangement, but is like a parasite consuming and weakening the host. Trotsky compares the situation to a corrupt and badly led trade union. Its leadership must be changed, but if attacked by the bosses, it only makes sense to defend it without ceasing to criticize it. And the key point here is you can't defend it without criticizing it, because the people that are in charge are going to destroy it, and you have to be building towards revolution for that. Now, this analysis was debated with critics both outside the Trotskyist movement and within it, and modified and refined at various points. Other currents within the Bolshevik Party characterized the regime as state capitalist, and Victor Serge records that the left opposition is sent to Siberia by Stalin, debated Trotsky's theses, and some came to a state capitalist position of their own. These and other theories presented all kinds of arguments about what had happened and what political consequences followed, and Marcel van der Linden, in his book Western Marxism in the Soviet Union, is that the title? Yeah, gives an extensive, if not exhaustive, survey of the positions developed along Marxist lines in numerous countries. For my purposes, the most significant thing about van der Linden's book is that he underscores the degree to which these theories were also responses to the global economic context outside the USSR, as well as developments within it. For Trotsky's analysis, as well as for the criticisms of it by revolutionary socialists, it is important to keep in mind that after 1929, even non-Marxists began wondering if capitalism was moribund. Liberals gazed in fascination and sometimes in admiration on the reported triumphs of the five-year plans in Europe, in Russia, pardon me. In the book, making the most thorough argument for his analysis, The Revolution Betrayed, was written in 1935-36, Trotsky makes many digs at the bourgeois friends of the Soviet Union. At the same time, it's relevant to note that when the Nazis took power in 1933, they began to reorganize the German economy using, anybody know? Four-year plan. Is that cute? All of this left people wondering, if capitalism is failing and these new regimes are more dynamic, does that mean something new is coming into the world? Are we looking at the wave of the future? The wave of the future was the title of the book by I think Ann Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's wife, she saw this happening in Nazi Germany, that this was the wave of the future and a good thing too. Okay. So keep in mind that these questions were in the air when a new round of debate over the Russian question within the Trotskyist movement began around the start of 1938, in the wake of the Moscow trials, with the fast approach of a Second World War growing ever clearer. Two leading American figures in the movement, James Burnham and Joseph Carter, argued that while capitalism had been destroyed in the USSR, it made no sense to use the term worker state, however qualified, for a regime in which the workers had no power, and the regime had just destroyed every remaining old Bolshevik the secret police could find. Whatever you called it, the USSR was neither a capitalist state nor a worker state. Elements of this argument were taken over by an Italian named Bruno Rizzi, who held that the Soviet system, fascism, and the New Deal were all manifestations of a new system he called bureaucratic collectivism. After the debates in 1939 to 40 led to a split in the Trotskyist movement, particularly in the United States, James Burnham abandoned Marxism entirely, later became an editor at the National Review, and just a total right-wing asshole of the first water. In 1941, he published a book called The Managerial Revolution, which argued that capitalism had created a new class of technicians and bureaucrats, which was seizing power and, as the Hitler-Stalin Pact showed, would consolidate the course of, consolidate this bureaucratic collectivism, consolidate as a world order in the course of war with the remaining capitalist countries. In the book, he predicted that the Hitler-Stalin Pact would remain in effect until they defeated all the capitalist countries, and then they might then turn on each other. Unfortunately for him, this was about 6 weeks before the, the invasion of Russia. Somehow, that never killed him as a pundit. He kept at it. So with all this in mind, this is the background that you need to know to understand what's specific about the Johnson Forest and Tony Clift theories of state capitalism. I'm going to beg for a little bit more time. Thank you. And say that while there have been other theories of state capitalism, as I said, offered before, these two sets these two models are responses both to what Trotsky's analysis was and to the critics of Trotsky. The Johnson-Forrest tendency, in which Johnson was C.L.R. James and Forrest was Raya Dunayevskaya, formed in the Shachman-led Workers' Party in 1941. The Workers' Party had formed in 1940. At the end of 1940, Max Shachman writes a remarkable article, which everyone should read, called Is Russia a Worker State? In which he basically says, look, the state owns the economy, runs the economy, owns the economy, owns the property. The state property, those are equal, those are this overlapping concept. Who owns the state? Okay? And it's pretty clearly not the workers, right? So it's clearly there's a Stalinist bureaucracy which exists, which is functioning as a working class. And of course, to Trotsky's analogy to the labor union, to the labor union, he says, you know, the fact that the workers are still listed as the owners are sort of like as if you had a lease to a house and you could prove it in the court that you own that house. But a bunch of gangsters move in, throw you in the basement, lock you up, and start running their operations out of the house. At what point does it mean anything anymore to say you have the lease on the house? It just, you know, it's a semantic game. Whatever the arguments to be had around that, the other currents around Shachman are less prone to seeing this as being still a basis for continuing revolutionary socialist opposition to Stalinism. There begins a real kind of a darkening for some people. There's references to the age of permanent counter-revolution. C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya in 1941 begin to sort of polemicize against this, and they create a counter tendency within the Workers' Party. It's very small at first. They start out with three people, and I think by the end they were up to about maybe 40% of the party, something like that, which was still under 100 people. But they put forward an argument about state capitalism, which first of all requires on a number of basic references from Marxism, which you find in almost any version of state capitalism, and beginning with comments by Engels in Anti-Durung, where he says, the modern state, whatever its form, is essentially an essentially capitalist machine, the state of the capitalist, the ideal aggregate capitalist. The more productive forces it takes over into its possession, the more it becomes a real aggregate capitalist. And a different translation says, the real collective body of all the capitalists. The workers remain wage workers, proletarians. The capitalist relation is not abolished, rather it is pushed to the limit, but at the extreme it changes into its opposite. State ownership of the productive forces is not the abolition of the conflict, but it contains within itself the technical conditions that form the elements of the solution. The Comintern's first manifesto, it says, development of the war has snatched the role of regulator and director from economic groupings to transmit it directly to the military and government power. The only question is who will henceforth take hold of the statified production, the imperialist state or the victorious proletarian state. In Capital, Marx says, in any given branch of industry, centralization would reach its extreme limit if all the individual capitals invested in it were fused into a single capital. In a given society, the limit would be reached only when the entire social capital was united in the hands of either a single capitalist or a single capitalist company. So in building on these quotations which legitimate the Marxian bona fides of the state capitalist concept, Johnson Forrest challenged not just Trotsky's conclusions, but his method, beginning with the policeman analogy. They say that the issue here is not the bureaucracy's issue is not that it's created around consumption, but around production. They undertake an analysis of economic development in Russia. Ryan Dudinskaya in particular does this. She goes to the Library of Congress, reads, gets every piece of statistical information she can find, and she finds, now in Capital, Marx has two departments for capitalists. Department one, which is production of means of production, producing raw materials, producing the tools that you need to continue having industrial production. And there's department two, which is sometimes called means of consumption, which is a clumsy phrase. Consumer goods would be better. A better way to put that. What they find in analyzing these statistics, even factoring in the degree of distortion that Stalinist propaganda involved, was to show that there's this enormous spike increase in Department One, while the workers' income falls, proportionally to the increase in productivity, but even relative to itself over time, it falls by like half. Now, if you can imagine just how little you had to begin with, and to have that cut in half, this is sweated exploitation on a level that really is not seen before a very very early capitalism in other countries. In volume three, Marx says, upon the basis of capitalist production, the social character of their production impresses itself upon the mass of direct producers as a strictly regulating authority and as a social mechanism of the labor process graduated into a complete hierarchy. This authority is vested in its bearers only as a personification of the requirements of labor standing above the laborer. It is not vested in them in their capacity as political or theoretical rulers in the way that it used to be under former means of production. In other words, the state, it doesn't matter that no old capitalists are in the new state. Okay, it's serving that function to exploit workers. The second methodological point is they strongly emphasize the difference between the exchange value and use value, which Marx sees as basically the antithesis within the commodity. They say, yes, okay, but that applies to labor power itself as a commodity. They are very early in discovering the economic and philosophical manuscripts of Marx from 1844, in which he says, among other things, when one speaks of private property, one thinks of something outside of man. When one speaks of labor, one has to do immediately with man himself. The new formulation of the question already involves its solution. So there's a major concern of Johnson Forrest is not just that a new class is exploiting workers, but that the workers are struggling to create use value for themselves. They're trying to, that there is an instinctive need to develop the working class's own capacities and powers. And that this is part of what is crushed by the Stalinist regime. And a critique of The Revolution Betrayed, called After 10 Years, C.L.R. James says, juggling glasses, failing to base himself upon the alienation of labor in the process of production, Trotsky fails to see the consequences of this upon the bureaucracy itself. Of what theoretical validity is his constant emphasis upon the incompetence of the bureaucracy? The Soviet bureaucracy is a reflection of the law of motion of the Soviet economy. The bureaucracy has no free will. It consumes more than the proletariat, but its social life within itself is a jungle existence. The various strata of the bureaucracy address each other in the same tone and manner as the bureaucracy as a whole addresses the proletariat. If the proletariat is imprisoned in the factories, the members of the ruling party are subjected to a regimentation and unceasing surveillance and inquisition that make the coveted membership in the party a form of imprisonment. The Stalinist official, from highest to the lowest, excludes his family from any participation, not only in his public or political life, but even in his thinking. It is a measure of protection so that when the arm of the NKVD falls upon him, they will be able to say with honesty they knew nothing about his political ideas. This catalog of crime, fear, humiliation, degradation, and alienation from human existence of a whole class is the fate of those who benefit from the alienation of labor. This is an extreme, this is far, you know, if you saw Mad Men, you saw the alienation of the capitalist beneficiary of capitalism. This is that with much, much fiercer consequences. While the Johnson Forest people criticized and rejected a lot of Trotsky's analysis, one thing that they kept was an argument that he made that basically the coming world war, as he said in 1939-1940, would decide all of these things by and very likely either the Soviet Union would collapse or there would be a revolution. It would be part of a wave of revolutions as had happened following World War I, and the proletariat would be able to restore its power. That clearly is not what happened. It's, however, there were layers of the Trotskyist movement which insisted that the old man said it, so it must be right, and they were in denial for a good little while. James P. Cannon, at one point, I think, indicated that as far as he knew, the war wasn't really over, as he said this in 45-46. And a joke, a Trotskyist joke from this period goes that the Johnsonites expect a revolution tomorrow, the Cannonites expect a revolution next month, the Shachmanites expect a revolution next year, and history has proven the Shachmanites to have had the most accurate assessment. But unfortunately, and holding to both this entirely commendable and something we can learn an enormous amount from, this emphasis on working class self-emancipation and the drive for that, combining that with the expectation of more or less apocalyptic capitalist breakdown, is a very unstable combination. Here we see a major distinction between Johnson Forrest and Tony Cliff, which, to be clear, is not the only question of difference in attitude or concept, but to some degree a difference in period. Cliff belonged to the British, was born in Palestine. Towards the end of the war, where he's radicalized, he's a Trotskyist in Palestine. He moves to England, joins the Revolutionary Communist Party, which at that point was the first and last time all British Trotskyists were in the same organization. Didn't last for long. The RCP leader majority rejected the general drift of the Fourth International's assessment of the period. Which is basically Trotsky, is that, you know, that basically the capitalist economy was dead as a doornail. It was not going to be able to revive. Revolution was coming in the short term. They rejected that and recognized the possibility that the post-war period would see both economic recovery and social stabilization. Tony Cliff was a very important figure in making those arguments. They also had a debate over the Russian question. Cliff was assigned to defend the generator worker state thesis, and somebody else in the party was holding the state capitalism thesis. In the course of working on this, each of them changed their opinion to the other. Okay, so in 1947, where are we at? Okay, very good. 1947, Cliff writes, and in 1948 begins to circulate within the movement an analysis of Russia as state capitalist. There's a fair bit of overlap in the lines of argument about inconsistencies or inadequacies of the degenerated worker state concept and in favor of the legitimacy of treating state capitalism as a category founded on classical Marxist tradition. That is to say, there's a lot of overlap between what Johnson Forrest says and what Tony Cliff says. There's not any real acknowledgement of this at the time. The major difference that I see is that Cliff is very much more lucid in expressing these arguments. The Johnson Forrest group is something of an intellectual hothouse trying to turn itself into a Bolshevik organization. And very often the arguments are really, well, half of them is not showing in the text that you're reading. So that's a complicating thing. The distinctive thing about Cliff's analysis, which I'm going to abbreviate like crazy here, is that capitalism, the distribution of work and commodity production is seemingly chaotic, but it's actually regulated by the law of value, which holds that basically the proportions of the commodities exchange at a rate proportionate to how much socially necessary labor time goes into each commodity. Now, Cliff emphasizes that the relationships among the, as he puts it, quasi-independent producers are organized to the extent that they are by the law of value. Cliff's interpretation of the law of value, drawing on Bukharin, is that the increasing concentration of capital leading to increased organization of production means a weakening of the direct expression of the law of value. And since the operation of the law of value derives the concentration of capital in the first place, there's a definite sense in which it is negating itself. And here I'll quote a little bit of Cliff, where he says, a state capitalism and a worker state are two stages in the transition period from capitalism to socialism. State capitalism is the extreme opposite of socialism. They are symmetrically opposed, and they are dialectically united to one another. Whereas state capitalism means the fusion of the unions with the state until they are ultimately annulled as unions, the worker state realizes the influence of the trade unions to the maximum. Whereas state capitalism signifies historically the totalitarianism of the state, a worker state brings the highest degree of democracy. And this is very similar to something Johnson Forrest wrote in 1947, where they say, proletarian democracy is not the crown of socialism. A proletarian democracy is the foundation of socialism. Cliff's analysis of state capitalism becomes very distinctive by the fact that it argues that the law of value is no longer operating within the society, but is imposed by military competition with the West. I will admit that I have thought about this for a long time, and I do not understand it. I don't see that it's something to my mind like talking about a four-sided triangle. I really hope that some of this older cadre can explain that aspect of the argument. But the important thing, and I'm trying to wrap up now, is that in each case, with both the Johnson Forrest analysis and the Tony Cliff's analysis, and I would argue even in its own way, some of Shackman's and some of Trotsky's analysis, is to keep the emphasis on the working class self-emancipation as the, not just the goal, but the basic criterion by which you assess historical developments and historical processes such as this one. And I will end with a passage from a Johnson Forrest text, which I think, it provides a good ending point, and I think it clarifies some of the issues at stake and some of the reasons why these seemingly very abstract arguments are things that we need to continue to think about and learn from, if I can find it. At a certain stage, a developing contradiction, so to speak, explodes, and both the elements of the contradiction are thereby altered. In the history of society, these explosions are known as revolution. All the economic, social, and political tendencies of the age find a point of completion, which becomes the starting point of new tendencies. The Russian Revolution is one such explosion. The examination of the Russian Revolution involves both. Administration. Pardon me. Thus, the Russian Revolution, as it is developed and declined, shows us the two most violent extremes that we have known in history. It is only dialectical materialism that can unite these extremes in logical and intelligible connection. It is the creative power, the democratic desires, the expansion of human personality, the record of achievement that was the Russian Revolution. It is these which have called forth the violence, the atrocities, the state organized as Murder Incorporated. Only such violence could have repressed such democracy. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.